Someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. I'm here today with my co-host, David Gibson.
Hi, Anna.
Hi. How's it going?
It is going great. It's good to see you today.
Awesome. Yeah, good to see you too. So David had this really good idea. I wrote an exhibit for the museum, a new exhibit that just opened recently. It's called Nuclear by Mail, and it tracks the evolution. It's very interesting because it's a history of both the atomic age and of mail and stamps and stamp collecting. And I'm really excited to talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, because it turned out to be a really cool exhibit with really neat information, things that you just, normally, unless maybe you're really into stamp collecting or really into postcard collecting, these are things that you wouldn't even really think about. I've taught a lot of lessons where I mention, all of the mail, in these things went to these certain locations rather than everyone giving their address. And I've addressed that, no pun intended. address that. Wow, that's bad. But I've spoke about that in classes a lot, but I never really, thought about, some of the angles of what you could, what you couldn't, send through the mail and kind of how that mail got there. And this is a fun exhibit showing that, some of the correspondence to and from. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a neat exhibit you put together. And I thought it'd be fun to kind of explore how an exhibit gets, from here's the idea all the way up through it's on the walls now, and talk about that because, we are a museum and we are a museum podcast. And so I thought it'd be kind of fun to go behind the scenes. And so we can go behind the scenes with Anna on this one here. Yeah. There you go.
I'm doing finger motions to show
I'll put some kind of fun little music in there.
Yeah, cool. So yeah, so one of the things, what we're using for notes today is actually an early draft of what's actually up, out there on the wall, just because in the process of writing an exhibit and designing an exhibit, there's a lot of back and forth between the collections department. So that's me. That's the person who's, doing the research and I learned so much about the history of mail and stamp collecting that I had no idea. And I got really interested in it. So I got a little bit carried away and added maybe more details about the history of mail and, like I said, stamp collecting, envelope collecting, and not as much about the nuclear aspect of it.
Okay.
And so that actually changed through the course of these like edits and drafts for what's going to go into the exhibit. So I thought that it might be fun to hear a little bit about, the things that I found the most interesting that didn't make it into the exhibit. So you guys get like a little bit extra information. About
right. This is the director's cut or the.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. This is that extended version of the exhibit out there.
Yeah. Because obviously, you only have a certain number of words on each panel before the person visiting the museum is going to get bored reading about anything, even the most interesting thing. You got to keep it short and sweet and directly about any objects that are on display.
Okay.
So, that kind of changes as the full exhibit is developed and, we can't use this object because it's got water damage or this just, we found this other postcard.
Right, something else comes up that's more relevant or interesting.
Exactly. So.
Now this exhibit here, people that come to visit museums that maybe don't work in museums or don't, have a whole lot of background there. A lot of times or sometimes exhibits aren't built and developed in house. They are great. Something that we'll get from, you know, a different museum. Mm-hmm. You know, we share things and you know, we'll rent something, things mm-hmm. like that.
We're a Smithsonian affiliate, right. So we do get access to some really cool Smithsonian things specifically.
Right.
But sometimes it's not even, you know, we don't have to only take Smithsonian
right.
exhibits.
Exactly. Yeah, so a lot of them are, like, collaborative between museums. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you're looking at an exhibit, especially your, like, temporary exhibits, mm-hmm. because they mm-hmm. travel a lot, or they'll be developed for a certain thing and then, mm-hmm. you know, sent to somewhere overseas, you know, it could be anywhere. So this one here was something that was developed in-house. We did come up with the idea, hey, what about nuclear by mail? Because mm-hmm. you had these cool artifacts. And so this came all the way from conception to on the wall, all in-house, meaning done by the people that are staff here at the museum.
Yes, that is correct. And this has actually been in development for many years. When I first got here, I was just volunteering. I was a summer intern, and they had already been working on this for a little while. So when I got here, I was assigned this. This exhibit was actually based off of two different collections that were donated to the museum. One was these two, actually it might have been three, but these gorgeous giant stamp albums that were all nuclear and atomic themed from this man named Stephen Stowe, who, you know, he had worked in the nuclear industry for a large part of his life, and he had collected stamps as a kid.
That's awesome.
And so he just, you know, started this collection, and he had been collecting for so long that it got to the point where he said that he had basically gotten all of the nuclear stamps that he really could get.
That were, oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. And so he decided he wanted to, you know, shift his focus to a different theme because he was done with this one. And he thought that it would be something that we could use. And we totally can. They're amazing albums. He has, like, context for each section. The books are organized into different categories.
Okay.
So he has categories ranging from Nobel Peace Prize winners, Nobel Physics Prize winners, all the way to power plants that have been featured on stamps.
Yeah.
And he's got a section on humor, and, you know, because a lot of cartoons use the,
exactly.
like, X-ray trope
right.
or the, like,
right.
or, you know, like, mushroom clouds.
Yeah.
Or, so it's a really, really interesting, I would call it a work of art.
Of course.
He's put so much time and effort into this amazing collection, and he donated it to us. So we thought, what can we do with this?
Now, kind of a question, you know, just the inside the museum question I would have mm-hmm. for you, I guess. You know, a lot of people don't, you know or take into account. When someone is donating something, is that every time? Are they giving it to the museum? Is it on loan? Is it what is that, you know, kind of process? Because you being in collections and kind mm-hmm. of dealing with that, mm-hmm. you know, these things aren't just something that we all found in a yard somewhere. They come from people
mostly
that have
not.
Been collecting. Yeah. I mean, some of them are. Yeah, that's very true.
But
a lot of them come from individuals or businesses or mm-hmm. the government.
Yes.
And do we own all of these things, or is that a mix? How does that process, or what is that process?
It's definitely a mix. So there's our typical donation. So I should talk about the other collection, the other donation.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I can talk you through how they got it. The other one was Bill Padacci donated hundreds of these beautiful, like, pristine condition General Dynamics covers. Cover is another word for envelope.
Oh, okay.
In the
I was going to ask because I didn't know what that. All right, there you go.
And so he, you know, he had this long career working for General Dynamics and had this huge collection of nuclear-powered naval vessels that he gave us. So the way that he went about that is he contacted the museum, or I actually don't know specifically for this one,
sure,
but someone contacted the museum and said, we have this, the hundreds of these envelopes. Do you want them? Then we say, yeah, that sounds like something we want, potentially. Fill out this form, potential donation form.
Okay.
Get it back to us. And then we actually have a kind of unique process because we need to make sure that we're not getting classified information
right.
or export control information.
Yep.
Just stuff that we should not have our hands on.
And that's something special to our museum.
Yes.
Those are, yeah.
Yes.
As well as the radioactivity levels, mm-hmm. things like that.
Yeah. So we have a little bit more complicated process than most museums, but most museums would also do the same thing that we do, where we take it to a board, our board members, and we say, these are all of the things that people want to donate to us. Should we take them or not?
Okay.
And then it goes around, it's called NAMARC. I don't know what that stands for, but...
There you go. NAMARC it is. Yeah.
Yeah. We have every 6 months, there's a NAMARC. You know, all the board members. So we have people who are who specialize in classification, people, export control, survey, like a nuclear survey.
Okay.
There's someone who like makes sure that we're not taking something that's a million rads.
Right. Yeah. That is going to be unsafe to
yes.
store here or to
exactly.
yeah put on exhibit.
And, you know, we pass everything around. We decide if it's relevant or not. We often get potential donations that are just World War II.
Okay.
And unfortunately, we can't take all of those because we are a nuclear museum.
We focus on a particular mm-hmm. aspect of mm-hmm. World War II. Yeah.
So unless it's the Manhattan Project or, you know, those two fateful days in August.
Right, right.
It's really not relevant to us. So that gets a little bit tricky because there
sure.
is some stuff that's kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
Like anything to do with a B-52
right.
is something that is both relevant and might not be relevant.
Right.
Because they ran missions that included nuclear weapons, but they also were just...
missions
know,
that did not.
Exactly. We all sit around, we vote on whether or not we're going to take an item. For this one, these hundreds of pristine General Dynamics covers, absolutely.
Yeah.
We said yes because they're beautiful, they're relevant. And I don't know what order we took them in, but
okay.
these two collections were accepted kind of, you know, we knew that we could make a nuclear by mail.
If we had the combination of these, we would have mm-hmm. enough for... an exhibit.
A male-centric.
Sure.
M-A-I-L.
They're very good. Very good. Yes, you're right.
But, you know, we could do something about the Postal Service.
Yeah.
About the ways that nuclear history is represented in this other history. So part of what I was writing about for this exhibit is about how both industries kind of develop together.
Sure.
You know, the one of the things I learned is that the Postal Service as at least as far as stamps go,
okay.
is not that old. It's like the end of the 19th century.
Oh, really?
That,
okay.
Stamps were invented in England and started to become standard practice around the world because it became clear that so the way that the post office works now is actually a fairly new invention, like
okay.
late 19th century, which I was very surprised about because, I mean, mail is ancient.
You kind of assume forever.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it's been happening always.
Yeah.
Like, you can go back and read letters from Romans.
Right,
and
so this was a letter. Yeah.
Yes. But a postage stamp is not that old. It's
That's crazy, yeah. You don't
a century
think about
or
that,
two,
or yeah.
yeah,
I don't think about that.
And basically, the reason that it was invented is that the Royal Mail Service in the UK was hemorrhaging money because you used to either prepay for a letter to be sent.
Okay.
You could split it between the person who was sending the letter and the person who was receiving the letter. Or you could send a letter and then the person who was receiving it had to pay to
then.
Collect it.
Right.
But It was usually that the person collecting it would pay. But if you didn't have the money to pay for
it. Right, and you've got a system that I'm sure did not have the logistics to it that they do now. Your letters either not getting there or, you know, people, you can't find them. They even addresses, you know, weren't as much of a thing. No. They're just like third house on the left over on whatever row.
Well, and it's also until, again, I think early 20th century, you weren't sending letters to someone's house.
Okay.
You were sending it to the post office or the general store or whatever. There was like a designated specific central location in each town or city where somebody would go and pick up their mail. And to do that, you would, you know, pay for it.
Right.
But there was like a pretty, it became clear that there were a lot of people who were, you know, holding the letter, looking at it real close, and then giving it back.
I don't need to pay for that.
Well, or there was a type of code that you could develop with someone. You could, you know, say, oh, well, if your niece is a girl, I'll put a little red cross in the corner. And then you could just look at the outside and say, oh, cool, and not pay for it.
Right. Okay.
So there were a lot of issues with this system. And, you know, they needed a way to make people pay for the mail they were sending.
Right.
And so that's how the stamp was born.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, see, that's a fun part of this process, or the, you know, things that you get to learn about. You know, it's the same with me when you're studying for anything. And yeah, you learn these. Oh, well, that's a cool little side something. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So, so in 1837, Sir Rowland Hill, who was a British schoolmaster and an inventor, he was also like a social reformer. So this is something that, you know, he just wanted to make payment for mail more uniform.
Uniform, right.
And he contacted the general post office and set it up so that, you know, this wouldn't be so much of a problem.
Right.
And that, a few years later, created the very first stamps ever issued by a government in the UK. It's called the One Penny Black. And if you Google that, you can see some cool pictures of just, it's pretty basic. It's like a picture of the Queen just on a black background.
And
yeah.
Kind of has the printable, like, you know, financial note or money vibe or feel to it.
It's got like intricate designs that you would need a specialized printer for.
Right.
On May 6th of 1840, Britain implemented this system as it was still optional at this point. It would become, you know, standard practice and not an option later on. But they didn't want to, you know, shock everybody who was taking their mail and then turning them away.
Exactly.
So, the United States Post Office Department saw how well this worked. And really quickly, you know, 2 years after that, the first stamps in the U.S. Were created.
Issued and,
Something that I found really interesting that I didn't know is that at this time, even though we have, you know, I mentioned the General Post Office, they all changed their names, and the United States Post Office Department, these were like government-run agencies.
Sure.
But post offices could be owned by a private person. So actually the first adhesive there like had a little bit of glue on the back stamps in the U.S. were actually created by a private guy in New York.
Oh, cool.
Who was
had
like,
this
idea.
Is
a great idea.
Yeah.
Let's use it. So, but it really didn't take that long for the U.S. government to say, oh, actually, this is a great idea. We're going to purchase the patent for these from you and implement them across the United States.
Nice.
And the first official U.S. stamps, like from the government, were 5-cent stamps that featured Benjamin Franklin on the 5-cent, and 10-cent was George Washington.
Nice.
So, and you can still look those up. They're, you know, you can see what those guys look like.
Yeah.
They're pretty. Yeah, they're nice stamps. Same vibe, same like money, yes, currency
feel, type printing. Right.
Yeah, very official.
And so this, like, you know, generation of the post office is, mm-hmm, kind of what led into, you know, people, of course, collecting these stamps. They yeah, became something that, mm-hmm, oh, well, you know, I have the very first one printed. Mm-hmm. So anytime you have something that has that mass, you know, push like that, you're, yeah, going to have collectors. And so that's what kind of leads us into, okay, well, people were now collecting these atomic or these nuclear, yeah, you know, mail or postage, mm-hmm, items.
Yeah, and the first commemorative stamps, because that's really what people tend to collect.
Okay.
Like, it doesn't have to be commemorative of a specific event.
Okay.
But that's what the first ones were. But it certainly pushed that collector's mentality to have something specifically connected to an event,
right,
that then makes it kind of rare because it's only, yeah, going to be issued for a certain amount of time, and that really, you know,
gives it value.
Mm-hmm. Collecting was not what it is today,
right,
because today it's very much like, I want this issue number from this country for this subject.
Right, right.
Whereas at the beginning, stamp collecting was more like, oh, cool, I like this one.
I have this, you have this, right.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
So, and it's really developed like a whole industry around itself for, you know, specialized books,
mm-hmm,
specialized tweezers,
yeah,
you know, different methods of soaking them off of paper.
Right.
You know, you got to be careful with any red ones, because if you do a red one or soaking a red one off with other colors, it might turn the other ones red.
I could bleed onto the other ones, right.
Yeah. So there's this whole culture and industry that really kicks off mostly at the end of World War II.
Right.
Because the economy was doing so well, people had
a little bit extra money, mm-hmm, to, you know, put into something like this. And, yep, yeah.
And on top of that, it was a world war. That means you're sending mail to and from all over the world, which means,
yeah,
that you're getting these cool,
that,
you know, if you're a 12-year-old living in Indiana and your uncle sends you a card from the Pacific.
Right.
You're going to think that's really cool.
That's a neat stamp, yeah, because, yeah, that's a, yeah, from another country. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's kind of how it really, really kicked off.
Yeah.
And then it became something that, you know, the Boy Scouts did, and that, like, developed these little niches like atomic stamps,
right,
or bugs. I used to babysit a girl who collected bug stamps.
Bug stamps. Yeah.
Yeah. So it really, really comes into its own and starts to include envelopes, which are called covers.
Okay.
Just because there's like a lot of different, I think it's a lot of different like technical types.
Okay.
Of some envelopes aren't envelopes. They're called covers.
Okay, sure.
Covers
is that kind of, I was going to say, envelopes that entire, or,
yeah,
covers. It gets bad no matter what route we take on that one. Yeah.
But then there's also, in the same line as the commemorative stamps, there starts to be commemorative envelopes being commissioned.
Sure.
And if, how do I explain this? If a cover has a little printed stamp on it, when it's issued, the printed stamp is called a cachet.
Okay.
And so then there's also this, it just makes your envelope fancier, basically.
Okay.
But that also means that's what those General Dynamics
covers
are.
Sure.
Is they all have like a little printed picture of whatever naval vessel they're commemorating.
Right.
And like a little, you know, when it was and why it matters, basically.
Awesome. Right.
So this, all of this just really fuels this industry and really creates a culture around what it, stamp collecting is actually, it has a special name.
Okay.
It's called philately.
Yes.
Philately. Yeah. I've also heard it philately. I'm pretty sure it's philately. But yeah, that's just the study of and collecting of stamps.
That's awesome. Right.
Yeah. So this new hobby is born. It really takes off.
So, you know, I had no idea that this would be something that would happen kind of simultaneously. And like you say, it's neat to think about, mm-hmm. you know, all of a sudden there really are stamps coming from around the world. Mm-hmm. And so now that's going to, you know, create mm-hmm. a spike in interest in these stamps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this nuclear edge to it is cool to, you know, yeah. see that these things were, one, developed, you know, mm-hmm. that they happened, mm-hmm. And then that we were able to get a hold of these things. Yeah.
Well, and it's also both of these histories are basically happening kind of like parallel.
Right.
So as we're getting, you know, development of stamps and then it's becoming standard and then people are starting to collect them, at the same time, we have Marie Curie and the discovery of X-rays.
Right.
And then, you know, like I said, I mentioned World War II. You enter the atomic age, and that's going to be something that people are talking about.
Right. It was huge in pop culture, mm-hmm. right, as well as, mm-hmm. You know, the, you know, scientific community. Yeah. It was a huge pop culture event. You know, these are new things that people are hearing yeah. about. These are, you know, what all of your comics of the time mm-hmm. and all your, you know, so many pulp novels and things were based yep. around. So, you know, it's makes sense that it would, mm-hmm. you know, overflow into something like this.
Yeah, yeah. So stamp collecting really, like, reached its peak in the United States during the 1970s when over 1,000 prominent stamp dealers were active. So this was both as a hobby and professionally.
Right.
At this point, you know, we have a concept of what's rare, what's not rare, what's interesting, what's not interesting. However, at this point, there was like a slightly different like style to collecting.
Okay.
People were collecting, they were trying to collect like the entire run of every stamp that a certain country had ever issued.
Okay.
And that was what was like valued.
The premium.
Yeah.
Right.
It's after this point that it kind of develops into whatever the stamp collector is interested in.
Sure.
Becomes what's coveted.
Right.
But, you know, with this shifting trend, rare and mint condition stamps start to command higher values.
Sure.
And so that kind of like in itself continues to generate interest because now there's a variety of circumstances that can make a stamp rare.
Right. Misprints mm-hmm. or, you know, the same as in, yep. you know, coin or money collecting. Right.
Yeah. You know, intentionally or unintentionally short runs of mm-hmm. a stamp, you know, war or economic instability. So like a lot of USSR stamps from certain periods,
okay.
from certain, you know, states within the USSR are really valuable because they just, you know, you can't access them
right.
easily.
That state may not even be there anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. And like you said, mistakes and misprints, the most famous misprint, I actually wanted to talk about this. I find it so cool, is an American misprint of a stamp known as the Inverted Jenny.
I've actually heard of this
right.
one. I don't know much
She's
about
so
it.
Famous.
Yeah, you can go ahead. Yeah, I, with very, very little stamp mm-hmm. collecting knowledge have heard of the Inverted Jenny.
Yeah.
yeah. No, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. It's really cool. It's so it's bicolored. That means it's only got, you know, the two mm-hmm. layers of ink. It's a 24-cent stamp. It was created for the very first airmail service. It's literally only one sheet of 100 stamps that were ever printed this way.
Right.
But it's got the little airplane upside down. And so there's this airplane just flying upside down on this stamp.
And it was for a postal service plane. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Right,
it's the very first like airmail service.
Right, and so it was a big deal
yeah.
to begin with
yeah.
that these stamps, yeah,
mm-hmm.
were being made. Yeah,
exactly. But this lucky guy, he was actually a collector. He was sold, William T. Robbie was sold the unnoticed error sheet, just these 100
right.
ever, on May 14th in 1918.
And so it makes it the holy grail of stamp mm-hmm. collecting.
And he was able to sell it to another stamp dealer for $15,000.
Wow.
And now, you know, you can find them in like one or two little chunks.
Sure, they divvied it up.
Yeah, there's a lot in museums. They're around, but they're really cool. I would say Google a picture. They're really
pretty. And yeah.
They look neat. So yeah, so that's just a single example of how you get these like really rare kind of strange stamps.
Right.
With all of this happening, there was also the development of postcards.
Sure.
So I actually personally collect postcards.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. And yeah, I will take that into account. Yeah.
I they're just the easiest souvenirs.
Right.
You can pack them flat. You can have like 25 and it's not even an issue.
Right. Not expensive. It's something that, can have meaning from wherever it was.
I decorate my room with them a lot of the time.
Okay.
They're easy. So, yeah. So, I love postcards. So, I found this really interesting.
So, this was a dear to your heart.
This part I was like, oh. It.
Right. Yeah. Which is a fun part of being in collections, I'm sure, is finding that one little niche thing that you're like, hey, this is what I'm really into. Yeah. And right now, I'm part of a museum collection about this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And this actually mixes a couple of my favorite things.
Oh, good.
One of my favorite like subsections of nuclear history is quackery.
Yes.
And I'm sure we've talked about that before. It's my favorite.
Right.
Nuclear medicine, but also like nuclear air quotes medicine.
Right. Exactly. Medicine. So, loosely based on medicine.
Yeah. So with the invention of the postcard, Austria was the first country to issue them. They're like pre-printed with postage on them.
Okay.
So that's kind of what makes a postcard is... Oh, wait. No, I said that wrong.
Okay.
So Austria actually became the first country to... They issued what was called postal cards.
Okay.
So this is like... This is if a postcard just already included the stamp.
Okay.
So it was like already printed on there and included in the cost of buying the postal card.
Okay, right.
And that was in 1869. So, you know, that this was just the predecessor to what we call postcards. And this postcards became a very easy and cheap way to advertise basically anything.
Right.
Like, you know, but how this connects to our collection is that we have a whole bunch of postcards that were donated to us that they're all radium springs and radium, you know, radium sulfur baths and come sit in our hot pack room where you breathe in the radon,
which was huge at one point, right? Mm-hmm. So to, you know, kind of that's historic and relevant to us and all of those wonderful things, in this postcard.
Yeah, and so these businesses really seized on this, especially because these kind of springs, these like medical springs, I guess I'll call them, were such a destination that it was really easy to, one, purchase a souvenir to take back with you, a postcard, and two, to be there if you were there for a few days and send one back to a family member saying like, oh, look, yes, my arthritis is so much better. And yeah, we have a really cool collection. The earliest ones that we have in our collection are from the 1910s, 19-teens.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So real early, like very much during the radium craze.
Sure.
And then all the way, the youngest ones that we have are from the 1960s.
Which are still advertising those radium springs. that's different there. Yeah. New enough to know better.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why I find this collection specifically so interesting. Another thing is that the majority of them, not all of them, there's a couple from Kentucky, I believe, but the majority of them are all out west.
Right.
So there's some kind of connotation about frontier having, obviously this wasn't the frontier anymore, but the romanticized Southwest and the romanticized idea of the West having these like scientific secrets. that would make you feel better.
And the, you know, with tuberculosis and things in particular, I mean, going out west for your health was, you know, was a huge thing. That was my family in particular, that's how we ended up here in New Mexico, was my grandfather was heading to Arizona because he had tuberculosis. They said, you're not going to make it to Arizona. Stop here in New Mexico. And that he lived here for 50 years after that.
Wow,
but so I guess it works. No, but you know,
it does,
but the
it does.
Coming for the dry air for tuberculosis, it was known, you know, if you have health issues, head out west because the because they knew even at the time a lot of these cities were so, you know, smoky and the
cold,
air quality and the cold
burning.
And it just kept, you know, everything just terrible for your respiratory system.
Yeah.
So they thought,
as well as
head
damp.
Out west. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, I'm sure, a lot that had to do with it was these, well, and you've got uranium and things out here.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's an interesting thing that a lot of them are going to be out here or even more west than we are.
Yeah. California was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that had several, because it also depends on where these springs naturally occur.
Exactly.
There were a couple in Canada too in our collection that I found really interesting because those ones actually were like, reformed radium springs. So it was still named radium springs, but the postcards are from the 1950s. Where they were no longer really, there's a connotation about like warm water and cold water and that being good for your joints.
Right.
But it's not as much about the medical benefits of radium infused water.
And,
and it's more about like, come to our like leisure park and they've got like picnic tables and hotel rooms.
Right.
And, you know, you hang out by the pool.
Yeah.
Versus like.
Come
Other
sit in the irradiated
come sit
water.
In this mine,
right,
this abandoned mine shaft,
right.
and breathe the radon.
Because it's great for your health.
It'll be better for
you.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just like a really interesting story that these postcards tell about how we view health, how the nuclear, you know, we've talked about before, having radium on something, even if it's not radioactive, even if it has no radium in it, has this connotation of like, oh, it's cool or good or scientifically advanced or high quality. So
because of radium.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's an obvious connection that we have.
Right. To that nuclear aspect.
Yeah. And we should mention, you know, this exhibit has more than just the stamps and the postcards and the envelopes. There are a lot of other elements that we just pulled from our collection. So we have a lot of letters that, you know, we have some that have been sent and received to Oak Ridge. We have some that were sent and received to Los Alamos, to the P.O. Box 1663, which was everybody's, and that's 1663 Santa Fe.
Right. It wasn't in Los Alamos. It was in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
And the reasoning behind that, you know, was, they didn't want people to know exactly where Los Alamos was, and they didn't want specific addresses. So everyone did have that address in Santa Fe as their address if they were working at the labs at the time. Right.
It keeps, you know, secret how many people are actually there. It also means that at this time there were sensors, C-E-N-S-O-R-S.
Correct.
Like,
right.
Who were going through and making sure that no secrets were coming out.
Right.
Nobody was talking about anything weird going in.
No photos with anything in the background that would give away even where they were.
Exactly. So that just made their job a lot easier. If it's all going to the same place, they can go through everybody's mail and then get it to them a lot easier. It's just a really interesting way of keeping this secure location, especially because Oak Ridge didn't have that same problem.
Okay.
Oak Ridge was, I would say, as secret, but it wasn't as tightly controlled just because there were more people and it just was not possible. Like, you were allowed visitors in Oak Ridge.
Okay.
Versus Los Alamos, I actually don't know if you were allowed visitors. I don't think you were. I think that if you wanted to visit someone, you went down to Santa Fe and
saw them in
there.
Santa Fe, right?
Yeah. So unless you were a spouse, you weren't going to Los Alamos. But Oak Ridge, you know, you could have your sister come visit for a few days.
Okay.
And that's why, although there were P.O. boxes in Oak Ridge, mm-hmm. they were like, you had your own one.
Right. It wasn't all to one place. There mm-hmm. wasn't as much mm-hmm. secrecy there.
Yeah. And then, of course, we also have a few covers in the Steve Stowe collection, the stamp collection, mm-hmm. where he kept a couple of covers. And one of those is the Oak Ridge, like, commemorative cover. So we have this keeping with the commemorative theme and the right. way that this industry works. They did a 60th anniversary ones in, I think it was 2003. You know, it had like a little, the ones that Steve Stowe had in his album have a little stamp of Enrico Fermi.
Nice.
They have an Adams for Peace stamp. And then they have this like cachet that's like printed that says, you know, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, 60 years, nuclear, and a little bit about the Manhattan Project.
Oh, that's awesome. Right.
And there's like different versions of them showcasing different aspects of what was happening in Oak Ridge.
These ones are not on display. So no. Now the things that you see on display in the museum mm-hmm. are nowhere near the entirety of our
there's
collection.
So much stuff.
Because our collection is way more vast than just mm-hmm. the things you see there, because we're also a way of archiving, you know, mm-hmm. it's not a museum keeping the mm-hmm. you know, the record keeping, the
yeah.
You know, keeping a safe place for these artifacts, yeah. you know, yeah. for future, whether it be to put them in an exhibit or just something to have as an archive,
yeah, for a researcher,
right,
for yeah. So our goal is always to get as much information to the public as we can,
right,
so that while it's still relevant and while it's still interesting to the public, mm-hmm. That's why we have Past Perfect Online, which is our of large chunk of our collection,
right.
All of our collection is
and
digitized,
you work on that also,
yes,
right,
and is put into the system. Past Perfect is the software we use,
mm-hmm.
And then we take all of the objects that aren't restricted. So we might restrict something for having someone's social security number
sure,
on it.
Sure.
We might restrict something because it was donated with specific parameters that you have to ask their permission.
Okay, before you can share it or yeah.
You know, there's a whole bunch of reasons that we might not make something public. But anything that we can pretty much goes on Past Perfect Online so that anyone can access it. And
how would one access Past Perfect Online?
I will put a link in the description.
Wonderful. Good. Yeah. And check that out. I've used that just in my, if I am going to be teaching a class, mm-hmm. I've used that. Or, you know, if I am responding to somebody's question, that is a very cool resource that the museum does have. Largely, thank you. To you, Anna.
Well,
but there's a good team.
Yeah, the one who like handles that one for the
yes,
most part.
Yes, and Sandy
I
is amazing.
Out, so.
Yeah, Sandy yes. is amazing.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank you for listening. I know you listen every time.
Right. And we really do appreciate you, Sandy. All the work that you put in keeping these collections, because you know, like we said, not everything is out there on display.
Yeah.
And to be able to say, okay, well, this person needs access to this artifact for whatever mm-hmm. research or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, to be able to catalog those and to be able to keep them safely, mm-hmm. you know, to where they're not degrading yeah. in whatever, you know, they're in. And in our case, there are things that are radioactive and that yeah. have to be dealt with, you know, in special ways.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's a large part of the museum is what happens behind those doors.
Preservation, yeah.
Right, and that preservation yeah. of our history.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, that's a neat thing. And I didn't, like say, want to interrupt on that part, but I did want to point out that not everything that, you know, that even we're speaking about here, and that's what's fun about this podcast, is you guys can hear about some of the stuff that Anna gets to see that maybe isn't on display.
Yeah.
And yeah, and a lot of those things you can find on that Past Perfect. So check that out in the links, just saying.
Yeah. 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 And one of the cool things about the Nuclear by Mail exhibit that here at the museum
right.
is that we actually, so I digitized Steve Stowe's album, stamp
okay.
album,
mm-hmm.
So that we could put it on some touch screens
right.
in the museum. So that means that you can go in and, you know, swipe through and really have a look at whatever page you find the most interesting. With those screens, our lovely exhibits, head of exhibits, Ryan Painter, he created these little QR codes that you can scan with your phone so that, you know, if you're not done, if you don't have time to look through every page of these hundreds of pages, you can go home and look at it on your phone.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I'll put those
yeah.
links down too.
Wonderful.
So that you can check out the exhibit remotely, at least the Steve Stowe albums.
Sure.
So, but yeah, that's part of the point, is making these things that are in our collection accessible. Mm-hmm. Like we don't, and the best part is we don't even have to put those albums out on display, which any item that is out on display is actively deteriorating more quickly than it would be in
storage. Sure,
than
something that's in.
That's just a fact of putting anything on display, which is also why, you know, I've seen museums that have like miniature collections on display and the light in the case only turns on when you walk up to it.
Right, because that light can deteriorate some of these artifacts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a great, I think it's a really interesting and really cool exhibit that's showcasing kind of the future of how exhibits are going to be made. It's interactive. It's partially online.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone can access it. And it's also neither in person or online, the whole story.
Right.
It means that you can experience part of it without being there. And when you're there experiencing it, there's still a little bit more for you to do at home if you
want.
Right,
to take home and get dig deeper into it. Yeah.
Or if you're my dad, go find a chair and look at. So, yeah, so one of the just a really interesting theme of this exhibit that I wanted to mention before we, you know, kind of wrap it up.
Sure.
There's actually two more like sections I wanted to do. So one is Operation Crossroads. This is actually my most favorite nuclear test series.
Right.
Because it's really, really interesting. It happened right after the end of World War II. So it was 1946. It happened, I'm sure you've heard of something called the Bikini. Bikini Atoll was where they did a lot of this testing in the Marshall Islands. And what makes these tests the most interesting to me is that this is before, so it's like it's right after its most secretive point in nuclear history. And for this series, it was very public.
Okay.
Like they intentionally made these tests more public than they would be in the future even. They had a bunch of press corps come along. They had a bunch of witnesses like on purpose. They had reporters and photographers and all these people come along to Bikini Atoll to watch these tests.
Right. Now, by tests, you mean like nuclear detonation tests,
like,
right? We're talking
in the water, above the water.
Right.
I think there were two main ones. There was Abel and Baker shots.
And these were the nuclear detonation, big mushroom cloud thing, right, that we see.
Yeah. And they were very like publicized, like the public knew about this and was following it and was paying attention. And because of that, there's a ton of like male memorabilia.
Oh, awesome. Right.
So you have cachets that are printed with little Bikini Atoll, like a little ship with a little mushroom cloud next to it.
Yeah.
You have letters to and from people during the test. You have letters to and from people before the test being like, hey, do you want to come be
We're gonna go watch this.
Yeah. So it's like this very public and very known nuclear test.
Right.
And then, you know, right after that, it goes back to being quite secret. And even this one, I wouldn't say it's the most public of them.
Right.
But
there's still a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually just came across this really cool photograph of one of the, I think it was Abel, shot Abel, where someone had gone through and censored the ships. So
oh, really?
It's a
mushroom
cloud.
Couldn't tell what kind of ships or, that kind of were. That's interesting.
And a few years later, you know, an uncensored version of that came out.
Right. But it's interesting to see that at the time they were like, there's something here that we don't want someone to see.
Because they had both Japanese ships and American ships.
Okay.
And so I think they were like trying to not let people know what their ships looked like and also trying to keep people from knowing what type of Japanese ships they had access to.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So Operation Crossroads has some of the best covers of this whole exhibit, in my personal opinion.
Yeah.
They're super cool. There was like stationery. It was great. So then the last thing, because of course we've talked about all of this very positive representations of nuclear development throughout this whole history, we then get to, you know, the 1960s. It's this really huge cultural touchstone moment where a lot of different movements, political movements are happening, women's lib, gay liberation, civil rights, all of these things happening.
Right. It's a huge time as far as just upheaval to the system, if you will. Yeah.
It's also a huge time for nuclear development.
Exactly.
And the Cold War is real cold.
I would say raging, but I don't know that that's the proper terminology.
Right?
Yeah, it's cold.
Like,
yeah.
In the 80s, it was also raging, but in a different way. Cold War is happening. Nuclear weapons are a big deal. It's a thing that people are thinking about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And from this touchstone moment, there becomes the anti-nuclear movement. So we are all very familiar with the peace symbol, right? Little circle with the line vertical and then two other little lines at like 45 degree angles off the bottom. Well, what I didn't know is that that was actually created and designed by a man named Gerald Holtam. And it was actually in 1958. So this is pre-hippies.
Right.
As much as we associate it with hippies now, it's something that he was a professional designer who, he actually graduated from the same school as me.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Royal College of Art alumni.
See, there you go. Yeah.
He created the symbol for this organization called the Committee Against Nuclear War. And the peace sign actually looks like that it's supposed to represent the naval semaphore for N and D, which stands for nuclear
disarmament. Right.
So this symbol was actually created as for nuclear disarmament.
Right.
Yeah. Which I didn't know that that's what the peace symbol was. From the 1960s on, it shows up on so many stamps, million different stamps,
because
it becomes so much a part of the culture.
The American culture at the time, right.
Yeah.
Or the world culture, actually, at the time.
Steve Stowe's collection actually has a whole bunch of New Zealand stamps that have peace symbols on them, like a whole range, which is really interesting. He also has this like commemorative stamp for Sammy Davis Jr.'s 75th birthday.
Awesome.
That was issued by Sierra Leone.
Okay. Yeah.
And it has him, you know, wearing a little peace symbol necklace.
Exactly.
And it's just a really interesting to see how this symbol has been incorporated over and over again.
Right.
And the other thing is that there's actually quite a bit of nuclear protest mail that happened at this time, you know, in the second half of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
The mail would have been the easiest way and the cheapest way for protesters and communities to connect and communicate with each other.
Right, and get the word out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. My favorite example of this is actually, we have a 1977 cover, cachet cover, that commemorates the life of Karen Silkwood, who I didn't know who she was until I started this job, now I know that she's like quite famous. This woman was a whistleblower from Crescent, Oklahoma. She was a chemist at the Kerr-McGee nuclear plant, and there were so many safety violations and just like really like nasty stuff going on that were putting employees at risk. And so she had like collected this whole dossier on all the things that were wrong, and she was actually on her way to meet a journalist to give that person all of this information when she got into a crazy car crash. That it's one of those things. I don't want to feed into a conspiracy theory.
Exactly, right.
But there's also enough evidence to say that she didn't just randomly drive off the road.
And I think that we, you know, to take that liberty, this is you and I. But yeah, that's one of those things that we do have, you know, these letters, these things that are, you know, addressing this situation.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, we can't say one or the other, but I mean, it appears to us, in our opinion, that maybe there was something more going on there.
It's really fishy. That's what I'll say. It was really fishy. And so because of all of this, Karen Silkwood became quite famous, and it's tragic that she died. However, her death actually made this even more public, and this plant, the Kerr McGee plant, then, you know, stepped up its game and started taking care of its employees and making sure that they weren't getting
safety precautions were
irradiated
taken.
Right. For no reason.
Exactly, right.
So, and that's why she's really important, and that's why this cachet would have been printed and sent out to people, was to, you know, let them know exactly who she was and why she deserved to be commemorated. And yeah, there's a lot of things in our collection like that. We have from the 1980s, there's this like highlighter green sheet that's all about, yeah, it's anti-nuclear energy.
Right.
And, you know, talks about, I believe this is like right when the WHIP was being developed, which is, I believe we talked about that last time.
We have,
time.
Right.
Go
yeah,
listen
exactly.
to our last
right.
episode.
Yeah, there you go. A little callback there.
Yeah.
Well done. Right.
So a lot of people were unhappy about that being put here in New Mexico. And so there's this, you know, I still get emails because I'm interested in what people are saying about this. I've signed up for this email listserv that, you know, is still talking about WHIP and is still talking about some of the concerns that the public
has
about these things. But yeah, it's great to be able to go back and look at this highlighter green letter from 1988 or whatever.
Which brings up another, you know, good kind of jumping point there, that as a museum, you know, it is the museum's job. We don't just say, okay, hey, you know, nuclear, yay. You know, that's not the position of the museum. We're here to document. We're a historic museum. It's not to show an opinion one way or the other. It's to show this is what happened. This is not, you know, and that's why we were very careful, you know, in saying, hey, you know, even though this one looks this way, that's NNI. But to say, okay, we do have these things in the collection that also document, you know, pros and cons of nuclear, or, you know, the way that nuclear has been handled or used.
Or perceived.
Or perceived,
you know,
exactly.
If you're scaring people, that's not great.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, that is, you know, I think a neat thing about this museum is that it does put a strong effort into being objective. I mean, we are a nuclear museum. It's right in the name. You know, but that is something that, you know, it's neat that you pointed out, was we also have that anti-nuclear, you know, things in our collections that show that, you know, there are two sides to every story.
Exactly. We try really, really hard to make sure that when you come here, you can draw your own conclusions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in collections and in designing exhibits and in create, you know, kind of to bring it all full circle, I guess, that is something, you know, terminology, you know, verbiage that you're using, you do have to take great caution in that, and that, you know, it's presented in a way that you can draw your own conclusions.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, here's our thoughts or our feelings on it.
Exactly. Well, that's what the podcast is for.
Right. Yeah. And that's what's fun about the podcast, is that we are two people who, you know, have this interest in these types of things. And so, you know, we have a little bit of leeway there.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the podcast is for, you know, primarily put out to our Atomic
History
patron members. And so, you know, we can share a little bit with that, you know, because this is a conversation with us and you guys out there. Thank you, Atomic History patron members.
Thank you guys.
You're right. And so, you know, it is a behind the scenes. And so, showing those pros and cons, I think, is pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, part of the reason I brought this up, the real behind the scenes part of this is that the protest section actually got cut from the exhibit. We didn't have room. It just, you know, there are certain limitations when creating an exhibit that go beyond, there are physical limitations. Right.
There is only so much space.
Yeah.
Right.
And if we wanted to show, we have on display the largest letter ever sent. I don't know if that's still, it was at the time.
Right, right.
These nuclear plant workers sent this letter to Richard Nixon, and we now have that on display.
Right.
And so we
chose. And it's the actual letter, and it's huge.
Yes, it's massive. It's massive. Right, yes. So we chose to do that instead of the protest section because it's, basically, it's got the same ideas.
Right.
It's, you know, it's
and
a matter of
spacing too. If you
happen.
See where that is, you know, you would have to put something, you know, if in the physical space where this is in the museum, it's up above, you know, kind of above everything there. And so you wouldn't be able to do a small, you know, things that were let, you know, small letters or postcards in this space. So
exactly.
It was a matter of when you're designing or, you know, coming up with these ideas for an exhibit, you do have to say, okay, well, you know, what is something that's going to be eye level enough for people to see, or it's got to be big enough that they're going to notice it, you know, if it's way up there.
Yeah.
And so in making those choices, sometimes that can be a factor is, okay, where would we put this? Or, you know, how is it going to fit into the general feel of the whole thing, you know, rather than giving a jarring, you know, visual or, you know, feel to the exhibit.
Yeah, exactly. So that's it. Just things get shuffled around, and I figured, well, I can share it on the podcast.
There you go, and
like
that's what
bonus.
This podcast is for, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's nuclear by mail.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Hannah, for giving us this like insight into how an exhibit happens, and research and things like that. I think that's been fun for me. To kind of hear a little bit of that end, and I'm sure for our Atomic History patron members.
Yeah, thanks for the idea. A lot of the time, it's just because it's what I do every day, and because it happens over such a like long period of time.
Exactly.
Like I said, I've been working on this since 2019.
Right.
So it seems very mundane to me, but I don't know. I'm just,
But yeah, to hear how a museum works, I think is wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you, Anna.
Awesome. Thanks, David.
And probably yet again, we will thank our Atomic History patron members. But we want to mention that we are kind of just putting out a hashtag and that, that we're there's a for Nuclear Science Week and for the upcoming COP26. Just check out the hashtag. Net zero needs nuclear.
Yeah.
Just check out that hashtag. There's, you know, a lot of stuff going on there about just bringing nuclear into the conversation.
Yeah. This is actually our description for this episode is probably going to have the most information for a while.
Right.
Because it's going to have three links, and I'm going to make sure to put that hashtag in
exactly.
there so that you guys can check that out.
Right. Because that is something that is, like I say, just bringing nuclear to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Check out that hashtag, and it'll take you everywhere. You need to go for that one. But thank you, Anna, for putting this together and for giving us this nice insight. This was kind of an interview with Anna today, which is fun. And I really appreciate it. I had a good time. So
me too.
Thanks again. And don't forget to wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
There you go.
Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.